Still education, yes.
Yulia, are you going to lead us through papers or Jeff?
I will just start with a quick introduction maybe and then we go to the papers.
Okay.
Do you need an introduction? A very quick one. Since February, the boards have been jointly discussing selected aspects of classification and measurement requirements for financial instruments with the objective to seek to reduce key differences in their respective models. In the course of joint deliberations, the boards decided to make modifications to their respective models to bring them closer together. The summary of the decisions reached date is provided in Agenda Paper 6 FISB Memo 163. At this meeting, the staff will ask the boards to consider accounting for reclassifications of financial assets. This is discussed in Agenda Paper 6A FISB Memo 164. This paper also contains an FISB only and ISB only sections. There are also three ISB-only papers which discuss transition requirements and presentation and disclosure requirements in light of limited modifications to IFRS 9. FISB will consider transition and disclosure at a future FISB-only meeting. With that, I turn it over to Jeff. Or Shah.
No.
Shah?
It's me.
Okay. Oh, Jeff. Oh, okay.
Hi, Shah.
Julia and Shah. So Agenda Paper 6A is talking about the reclassification mechanics. The first part of the paper discusses the reclassification date and mechanics for reclassifications between amortized cost and fair value profit or loss. This part of the paper is relevant only to the FASB because these decisions are already made in IFRS 9. So the first topic for discussion for the IASB is the mechanics for reclassifications into and out of the fair value OCI measurement category. The questions to the board are in paragraph 46 of the paper, but we'll walk through each scenario separately in this education session. So the first scenario, scenario 3, in paragraphs 28 through 30, discusses the reclassifications from fair value OCI to fair value through profit or loss. The staff recommend that upon reclassification, the fair value changes that have accumulated in OCI be recycled from OCI to P&L on the date of reclassification. This is consistent with reclassifications from amortized cost to fair value through profit or loss, where the difference in carrying amounts is recognized in P&L. Thus, the P&L profile is the same for reclassifications out of fair value OCI and amortized cost. Do you have any questions or comments on this first reclassification scenario?
No questions?
Great. Then we'll move on to the second one, scenario 4, in paragraphs 31 through 35, which is reclassifications from fair value through profit or loss to fair value through other comprehensive income. So the staff believe this mechanics are straightforward in this scenario. The asset will continue to be measured at fair value, with fair value changes subsequent to reclassification recognized in OCI. Interest revenue and impairment expense will, however, be recognized in P&L in the same way as the financial asset measures at amortized cost. Does anyone have any comments or questions on this classification?
On this straightforward issue.
Yeah.
Just so I'm sure there's nothing that I'm missing, in paragraph 32, you refer to particular changes in fair value subsequent to the reclassification date. What do you mean by particular?
I'm talking about fair value changes that are not interest, revenue, or impairment expense.
Okay.
Any other questions on that scenario?
Could I go back to the previous one, the example in paragraph 35?
35?
Yes. Could you just explain to me in the very last journal entry why that wouldn't be 70 money units? Why it's 30?
What the expected loss amount is?
The loss is 30, 10 in the first year and then 20 additional.
Yes. Let's say again, the loss is 10 in the first year.
The initial recognition was 10, and then it is 20, I think, in the first year when it's okay. Yeah.
Because
okay, got it. Thank you.
All right.
Okay, move on. Still on Jeff, yeah?
All right. So So next we'll talk about scenario five, reclassifications from amortized cost to fair value through other comprehensive income in paragraphs 36 through 38. The staff recommend that any difference between the amortized cost carrying amount and the fair value at the reclassification date should be recognized in OCI. This is consistent with reclassifications from amortized cost to fair value through profit or loss, except that the fair value change is recognized in OCI rather than P&L. Does anyone have any comments or question on this scenario?
Right after lunch.
That's great. That was a bunch of our sessions. All right.
Very good suggestion, PK, for future agenda planning.
All right, scenario six, paragraphs 39 through 46. Reclassifications from fair value through OCI to amortized cost. The staff have identified three alternatives for this scenario. All of the alternatives would measure the financial asset at fair value on the reclassification date. The primary difference between the alternatives is the timing of accounting for the fair value changes that have accumulated in OCI prior to reclassification. So alternative one would derecognize the accumulated OCI balance against the financial asset, which results in an amortized cost carrying amount at the reclassification date. Alternative two would maintain the accumulated OCI balance related to the asset until the asset is derecognized. And alternative three would amortize the accumulated OCI balance over the asset's remaining life. The staff recommended alternative one because we don't believe the accumulated OCI balance should be maintained after the asset is reclassified. This is the simplest approach and results in an amortized cost asset that is comparable to other assets measured in amortized cost which were not reclassified. Do you have any comments or questions about this scenario?
I want to ask you a question. When you do the fair value through OCI, the impairment expense, whatever the first 12 months, you book it immediately on day one. Let's say that it's $1,000. I'll take your own example, $4,500 as the fair value on the day of purchase, and you immediately book $20 as the day one expense. But the fair value still remains at $4,500, right? I thought you need to have another entry in the fair value through OCI to reverse the impairment through OCI account. Is that right?
In effect, yes, because you need to adjust the carrying amount of the asset and do another entry in OCI.
Yeah. Now, tell me something. After 3 days, the CEO got fired and a new CEO came and the business model changed for good reasons. When you reclaim, they said it's no more a fair value through OCI. It's happening in all the banks right now. The CEOs are getting fired, so it's very possible. So what happens when you reclassify that to amortized cost? I'm at loss how to do that. Can you explain it to me? Your entry, your alternative one talks about it after the first period. And I just want to make sure that it happened 3 days after the initial reclassification. Will there be any change in the accounting? Because I have difficulty in conceptualizing it.
Is the question, you know, is it a 3 day or 3 year issue? Is that where your question is coming
from? It's a 3 day issue. It's like, suppose it's like it happened immediately because the fair value did not change. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, the fair value did not change.
Gotcha. Well, then when it's reclassified, and Jan, if I can jump in, this is kind of an impairment question, but the impairment allowance would be established for the amortized cost asset, and so any amount that was in OCI would be reversed depending on which alternative the boards choose.
So you're saying there's no change if the fair value remained at $4,500 in my example, because when you do this, I thought when you see the alternative one or any other, first of all, alternative one, your first entry is debit, asset, credit, cash. Second entry is debit, impairment, expense, credit, OCI.
So
when you reverse it to the amortized cost, how does it happen? Just help me with that.
So basically, if you go with the staff recommended alternative, your OCI is reversed against the carrying amount of your asset on the balance sheet. So your asset on the balance sheet goes from fair value to a carrying value net of day one impairment.
So using the numbers in the example,
So assuming you're on the 1st of January, well, you're on the 4th of January X1, you would just debit OCI 20 credit allowance.
Yeah.
20.
Correct.
Come again? I'm sorry, I'm listening too carefully.
You just debit OCI 20 and credit allowance balance 20. Because the carrying amount of an amortized cost asset isn't fair value. Yeah. It's the amount net of the allowance. That's how the impairment model works.
So you debit OCI credit impairment expense, then you have
to credit the allowance. You have taken the expense already when you establish it.
I was hoping you. I was hoping you would credit the expense.
Because P&L is the same under amortized cost and fair value OCI, so I shouldn't be touching it.
Any other questions there?
And I have only one remark. I agree to this alternative and the recommendations, but I think it is strange if you reclassify something from fair value through P&L and then to another cost category, and when you then establish first time your expected loss, and in this scenario, then if the fair value has already dropped from original fair value to a lower fair value, and in some scenarios that has reflected already an expected loss, because you should assume expected or a fair value should already have include your expected loss. If you have booked it, in my exact example, let's assume 4,500 was a fair value at initial recognition, and then the fair value dropped, let's assume to 4,000. So you have booked already 500 through P&L expense. Mm-hmm. And let's assume in this 500 were already included, in our example, the 30 expected loss. Then what you're doing in this example, you're booking this expected loss twice through P&L. And that is for me a little bit strange, and I don't have a different solution to that, but at least that is a consequence, as you have booked it twice through P&L.
That's a consequence of the bucket one decision.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Just keep it at fair value.
Could you help me a little bit with the end of paragraph 45, where you compare scenario 5 and 3, where you say the only difference between scenario 3 and this one is that it would be inappropriate to recognize the accumulated OCI balance in P&L. You didn't explain very much on this assertion that it is inappropriate. Why do you think it is inappropriate to recognize in P&L the accumulated OCI?
It's because you've gone from, because it goes back to the logic, I think, of this idea that P&L would be the same whether you've got amortized cost and OCI. So we thought that it was inappropriate to have a P&L consequence of moving from one category that was there's no change in the P&L.
Yeah, but it denies the fact that there has been some history to this asset before it was reclassified. So then you assert that you do as if it had never been classified otherwise than amortized cost, which means to forget about history, or should recognize that history does matter. It's been out of amortized cost for some time, and then it moves to amortized cost. So can it be exactly the same between the two situations? It has been always at amortized cost as compared to it has been in OCI and then it moves to amortized cost. I'm not sure I understand why you want to say history doesn't matter. I do as if I had always had amortized cost.
I think because if you had measured it at amortized cost, you wouldn't be recognizing anything in P&L unless you de-recognize the asset, and similarly if you were measuring it under fair value through OCI, you wouldn't have been recognizing this amount unless you had a de-recognition. So we didn't think that it was appropriate to have a P&L effect going from amortized cost, or from fair value OCI to amortized cost. But obviously we thought it was something valid to consider, otherwise it wouldn't be a scenario in the paper, but on balance we didn't think that it was the one with the greatest merit.
Okay, just saying that you don't explain it very well. It's asserted that you don't do it because it's not appropriate, but the rationale is not in the paragraph. So I think we need, in the basis for conclusions, probably to explain if you have considered the scenario and said we don't follow that route, to explain why.
Martin? I'm going to ask another question. When I look through all these papers and in this scenario, when you have fair value through OZI, and when you then establish your first expected loss, when you're doing the entries, debit P&L, credit OZI, and as a consequence that really your equity is not impacted by this initial recognition of this expected loss. And I ask myself, is that right? Because purpose of that is, okay, you want to have established an expected loss. It's really not reflected in equity, because based on that entry. Wouldn't it be better if we book debit P&L and credit and allowance? When I know that is because you should have your assets and fair value through OZI kept on your balance sheet at fair value, and if you establish then the allowance, you don't do that. But it is fair value minus established expected loss. That is what we're doing. But we don't reflect that it's a balance sheet.
I don't think we should focus on the balance sheet. Equity.
No, I focus on
we
equity.
We should focus on the asset. The asset category is fair value. So we need to think about is the asset reflecting the fair value net. That's the suggestion, rather than thinking about what is the impact on the equity. I would think about the characteristic of the asset, how it is measured on the financial statement.
But for me, it would be more important if I establish an allowance for a special asset, that this allowance is also included in equity, instead of looking at is the asset on the balance sheet reflected at fair value or fair value minus something. For me, more important would be in this scenario what is in equity, and not how the asset is kept on the balance sheet. And as I said, if we do it as proposed here, the equity position is neutral, because P&L is debited and OZI is credited, which means at the end, equity is not impacted by establishing this initial expected loss.
But I think that reflects the essence of the decision we actually took, was that we wanted to get the income statement, profit and loss, to reflect the exact same treatment as amortized cost, but we wanted the balance sheet to reflect the fair value treatment. And that's what you get to.
I know, but
it's the essence of that decision.
Reason for my question, which is more valid, is it really to reflect the asset on the balance sheet at fair value? Is that more important than really if you granted in the first time impairment of that, is it reflect that in your equity?
To my mind, the problem is that in suggesting what you're suggesting, you'd say that you're going to reflect an income statement or profit and loss that is aligned with amortized cost and a balance sheet that is aligned with amortized cost. And the only thing is that the balance sheet also has the fair value number on it.
It
that
is,
means you've actually got a
fair
third
value
valuation
anymore.
Level.
It's not going to be fair value anymore.
It's only a presentation. I would have the asset on the balance sheet at fair value, and on the liability side, I would book that at allowance.
Would you book
because that is that's consistent with the model, because we have a fair value asset, but it is not fair valued through P&L. It is fair valued minus the expected loss.
It's a completely
a model.
It's a completely different valuation though, because then you've got a fair value under fair valuation, and the amortized cost, you've got the amortized cost less provision.
But that is
under this model, you've got fair value less provision.
But there's a consequence if you have a fair value asset, and for this fair value asset, you're includes the expected loss model, because then it is not fair value and it's not amortized cost. It is fair value minus an expected loss. That is what you're doing.
Then
it is not just, it is implicit in when you're doing that.
Under what Martin is proposing, Martin, don't you then end up hitting equity twice for the expected loss, because the asset's at fair value, so it's in that fair value is already implicit the expected loss, and then we're taking another expected loss and hitting equity. So if you don't put that inequity, you're in effect, I think, double counting inequity.
I don't think you're double counting, Pat, but you will reverse that double counting. You will reverse it.
Yeah.
I think at the end of the day, the equity will remain the same.
What happens when the asset deteriorates to such a point that it's, say, worth 40? You've got the fair value of 40, you've got this liability of 60. You've got a negative asset.
My point is only at initial recognition, because that is when the problem is. When the fair value has already dropped, that was my speech some minutes ago, and then if you're doing that, then you have it twice. That is not my proposal. So my proposal is at initial recognition, then this problem occurs. It is not when your fair value has already dropped to a value further down, and that includes an expected loss. Then you don't have it twice.
So what do you do on day two then?
When they do, you have to distinguish, is it already reflected in your fair value drop, yes or no? That is what you have to do in this scenario.
Would you apply this to fair value P&L?
No, only to fair value.
Because isn't there the same expectation of losses for those assets? And would you make the allowance a liability for assets at amortized cost?
It is only presentation. If you have this liability, if you showed on the balance sheet cross on net, that is only if you have established an allowance in the liability side, or you book it against your asset for amortized cost. It is only presentation.
But okay, going back to my point about the asset at 40, so you purchase a bond for 40.
Purchase a bond for 40, right? Yeah.
It was issued as a AA bond, it's now CCC.
Yeah.
What's the accounting entry on initial recognition? Credit cash, debit asset 40, debit P&L, credit liability 60, well, or 50, or 45, or whatever the credit losses are, and you end up with a net negative asset?
No, he's not suggesting that.
Yeah, but if you book it in OCI, then you have the same impact, right? My problem is when I don't have a solution present, but my problem is, as I said, if you're doing that, you don't have at initial recognition when you establish this expected loss, you don't have impacted any equity. Because if you book it against OCI, you have P&L, debit and credit, OCI, which is for equity, it is neutral.
Well,
I don't have present a solution for that, but Julia, question is that right?
I think I would agree with Steve, and I would build on the point that Steve made. I think this effect is similar to financial assets which are carried at fair value through P&L. So as long as your measurement objective on the balance sheet is fair value, your effect on equity, your net effect on equity is bound to be zero. And this is the same with financial assets through P&L. You already have some expectation of losses, but they are at fair value, and therefore there is no effect in equity.
Yeah, but for fair value through P&L, you don't book at day one, yeah. You don't book exactly. This expected loss.
Which is what
then the question is, but I think, okay, if you book it debit P&L, credit OCI, no impact on equity, why don't book it at all? What is the purpose of that?
Because we wanted the P&L to look like amortized cost and the balance sheet, which also includes, therefore, the overall effect on equity to look like a fair value model.
It's like a dual accounting model, amortized cost model for P&L purposes and fair value model for balance sheet purposes.
It is that strange.
This problem, right?
That which, causes, is, which is strange.
It's consequent, but that causes this problem. This is only my point.
Combination of the objective of having a P&L that looks like amortized cost and a balance sheet like fair value combined with the bucket one model.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I test another point on the same example? If you look at all the entries in alternative one of the table here, in the end, what happens when you reclassify, at the time of reclassification, you had a net asset on the balance sheet, net asset of 4,430. That was your position before reclassification. Okay, 4,500 minus 70 OCI accumulated, right? And the new, 4,430 was your position at the time of reclassification. After reclassification, your net asset balance, net of the allowance, is 4,470. So there is a net revaluation of 40, increase in the asset value. Disregard what happens with P&L OCI, that's what happens in terms of equity. And doesn't create an incentive in those situations to reclassify from OCI to amortized cost. If you follow the entries, you have a net revaluation of 40 on the net asset balance. If you compare net of allowance versus net of OCI reserve.
We should really
increase, okay? Which can be explained by the reversal of the 70 accumulated OCI minus the setting up of the 30 allowance for credit risk. So the net is plus 40. And I'm just worried that it might create some incentives for people to reclassify at the time.
Although noting that reclassification is a very high hurdle.
Mm. Okay, there is a hurdle, but there is an incentive at the same time. So it will be
And that the effects are determined based on the fair values as of the beginning of the reporting period after the reclassification date. So it's hard to cherry pick the result.
Yeah, but really, subject to the limitations of the hurdle of reclassification, at some point people will say, well, I have an accumulated balance in OCI because the market value of this asset has diminished, which is more than what I would have done if I had kept it at cost or had it at cost and only recorded the allowance for credit risk. So I have an opportunity to increase my equity by just reclassification. And in days where banks are short of equity or really looking for more equity, I think there will be some pressure on the people to do it. So I hope the model will resist in terms of the business model, but.
Okay, so I guess we'll move on. The final section of the paper discusses reclassification disclosures and is only for the IASB. The staff have considered if any additional disclosures are necessary given the addition of a fair value OCI measurement category. I do not believe this is the case, other than extending the existing reclassification disclosures in IFRS 7 to reclassifications into and out of the fair value OCI measurement category. Do you have any questions or comments on the proposed extension of the disclosures?
Any question? Paragraph 50, last sentence. However, the ISP decided that this disclosure is not necessary for the long term because requiring information about the former measurement category is inconsistent with the objective. What is the long term? How long do you provide this disclosure?
You provide it until the next annual reporting date.
The reason why I suggested that, I know what that's the current requirement, it might be of interest, is, you know, you think back to October of 2008, those dark days when we made this change to the accounting of IAS 39. That change was of great interest in that quarter, but I know investors wanted to also follow that change thereafter for several periods. It's almost kind of like a loan that's been modified. You want to know whether or not, subsequent to its modification, it is continuing to perform, and typically it will in the first year because you give them more relaxed terms. Where the proof of the pudding, or the modification, so to speak, comes into play is usually post 18, 24 months and later, so that they don't become chapter 22s or 33s, so to speak. So the same is true here. If you've reclassed a significant amount of securities or loans, you probably did so for a reason. They're probably poorly performing, and you expect them to poorly perform for some time. And hence, you want that volatility out of your income statement and your equity. So you want to take them to amortized cost. And so I think that's a disclosure that would be of great interest to investors, particularly, for example, if they were Greek bonds. So you're looking at me with a quizzical look. Why is that?
Just thinking about what you're saying.
you don't think that would be of great interest? If somebody moved $5 billion of, say, securities into the amortized cost portfolio, from fair value OCI or fair value P&L. You don't think there's a motivation there to more or less manage earnings or manage equity?
I think that would be of great interest. I'm just questioning whether that would meet the criteria for reclassification with a change in business model.
I'm not going to even go there. I'm just saying if it happens, yeah, and if it is justified, okay, I'm just suggesting that it should be disclosed for a longer period, tracked, if you will, than just to the end of the annual reporting period. So if we're taking a fresh look at this disclosure, then I suggest...
Let's talk about limited modification.
Yeah. I hear you. I think this is an area that we should tweak a little bit.
I'm sort of guessing, without having been around when that decision was taken, that one of the reasons would be that it is a business model change, so it's not that you've moved assets from one place to another, it's that you've actually changed the way you've managed those assets. And I presume what's then assumed to happen is that there'll be assets coming in and assets going out of your new business model. So you might be adding, it's not a closed portfolio we're talking about of identified assets.
That's where
portfolio.
I would disagree with you, Daryl. I would say that management fully understands which assets they've moved over, and I bet you they are very cognizant of their values, and they're watching them very carefully.
I think there may be both circumstances, put that way. But my understanding of this was certainly the original intent was to capture a genuine change in the business model. And that implies that this is not simply taking assets and parking them somewhere and letting them run off. This is actually managing those assets differently from that point in time going forward. And that could be for many, many, many years.
That's the best explanation of the board's decision in October 2008. I don't think that was the decision.
Well, I think we probably...
2008 was reclass of individual assets. IFRS 9 was a business model test. It's two different things.
I thought you were referring to the October 2008 decision.
No.
October 2008 did have the long-term disclosures, which we heard a lot of negative comments about from preparers. But I would agree with Daryl. I think that the whole reason why this would be occurring is very different to the 2008 reclasses.
I respectfully disagree. I think that the whole business model is a red herring. Okay. A complete red herring. We're going to get research on it, I guess, to disprove my view here in the near term. But
just in the long term, I think.
Yeah, I hope it's in the long term. But I would suggest that we retain a requirement for disclosure here. If the value of this portfolio, meaning the unrealized losses here, continue to be as great, if not worse than what they were at the date of reclassification, that is something that should be noted and disclosed.
But the fair value of the portfolio is already disclosed, the fair value.
In the aggregate.
It's not identified to that specific bit.
Right. But we want to give people an understanding as to what's happening with this portfolio, because I think it will also give some insight into why the business model changed.
Yeah.
We have to be careful not to create the impression for those listening that the business model is meant to be a rare event. It's meant to be things like acquiring a new business, selling a business unit.
I don't disagree, but we can't police that. We hope that the auditing profession, the preparers, and the regulators are applying the principles faithfully.
They are all listening.
So,
but because it's a rare event, creating a disclosure requirement should not be too burdensome.
Exactly. There you go.
But it could, and I think unlike the 2008 reclasses, which did involve large portfolios for some people, but I don't think, thousands and thousands of assets. If you're talking about a change in business model, you could be talking about thousands and thousands of assets that you'd then be requiring people to provide disclosures for extended periods of time. So I think that you're right, because it's some change in business model, it could be a very big scope.
Well, I would suggest that
it would only be
required when the unrealized loss continues to be as great, if not worse, than what it was at the date of reclassification.
That requires the tracking.
For the assets that you were there, you're going to track them?
Yeah. Absolutely, because the reality is they will be tracked. That's the reason why they're being reclassed.
I think we have to look here at cost benefit, right?
I track individual assets, and if you have two or three reclasses, maybe, how should you do that? And I think if you compare that to the IAS 39 reclassification issue,
I think if IFRS comes into place, we have a different impairment model for incurred or for amortized cost stuff. And if you think, okay, that really credit-related losses should or would not be identified, then you have to make questions impairment model. But I think if you rely on the impairment model and expected loss is better than incurred, you should not have this kind of concerns. That is what I think.
I have these concerns.
Yeah, but that is misused maybe by some people, but we should not make such kind of burden to any other users because you think a little bit of misuse from.
Yeah. Unless abuse could be rampant, but we hope that that is not the case.
I also add that the staff has extended this disclosure to two different reclassification scenarios, but this was originally written for reclassifications from fair value P&L to amortized cost, which we think is the strongest case for needing this disclosure. The cases we recommended for we think are a weaker case. So, when the board is writing IFRS 9, they decide that 1 year was sufficient in the strongest case. So I think it'd be a tough sell to think of these other fair value OCI cases that use additional disclosure for the weaker cases.
I don't follow that logic at all. Why is it a weaker case? You're losing fair value information.
The most extreme change is amortized cost of fair value of P&L.
I don't disagree, but you're losing fair value information. And you want to know what the earnings impact, what earnings would have otherwise been, not only for that period, perhaps subsequent periods.
But if you think fair value OCI to amortized cost, you're losing fair value information, but you're not changing the P&L like you are from fair value P&L to amortized cost. So you're not losing the P&L effect is not as dramatic from fair value OCI to amortized cost. You're not hiding fair value.
Either P&L or equity effect. It's one of the
two. Can I ask you something slightly different?
Slightly different or completely?
Slightly different from this, yeah.
But,
now, tell me, I just want to understand, this is a joint paper between us and the FASB. Is there a difference in the trigger points for reclassification between us and the FASB? I ask that question because the staff has gone to some extent in explaining the FASB's type of reclassification in a little bit more different way than ours. So I just wanted to understand practically, is there a difference between the two? I hope not, but I want to make sure that there is no difference between IASB and FASB in terms of the trigger points for reclass.
PK, it's consistent between IFRS, what's currently in 9, and what we've deliberated on the FASB side. So the triggers are consistent. It is a very infrequent.
Because your language is slightly different, that's why I'm asking. Look at the 1 and 2, you'll see that.
Okay. Consistent. Other questions? No? Yes? Okay, move on.
That's this paper, so we'll move on to
transition. I was actually going to provide a rather detailed tee-up on transition because it's a very complex topic. However, I'm mindful that we only have 20 minutes left and we have 3 papers to talk through.
Yeah. So which paper are we doing now?
Okay, so let's start with paper 6B. So maybe just to set the scene. Agenda paper 6B talks about how classification measurement requirements should be applied in light of limited modifications, whether it's prospective or retrospective, basically. Agenda paper 6C focuses on when limited modifications should be applied and considers the interaction between phases of IFRS 9. So maybe we should start with agenda paper 6B. And just as a very quick introduction, so basically, the staff believes that because the board decided to modify or clarify contractual cash flow characteristics assessment, this introduces more judgment for some financial assets. And therefore, for some financial assets, retrospective application of contractual cash flow characteristics assessment would be impracticable due to risk of hindsight. For such financial assets, the staff recommends that retrospective application is performed based on IFRS 9 2010, that is pre-limited modifications. The staff does not believe that changes to business model or changes to fair value option warrant any changes to how classification measurement requirements should be applied. Do you have any questions? Okay. Shall we move to agenda paper 6C? Fantastic. So agenda paper 6C talks about fair value option for those entities who early adopt an interim version of IFRS 9. It also discusses other early adoption questions, presentation of comparative information, and make some observations around first-time adopters of IFRS. On fair value option, the key point is that today IFRS 9 requires a full clean slate on initial application of classification and measurement requirements for financial assets. This is because when you initially apply new classification and measurement requirements for financial assets, classification and measurement changes, therefore accounting mismatches change, and therefore you can revoke all your previous designations and make new designations. The staff notes that if an entity applies an interim version of IFRS 9 and then applies limited modifications to IFRS 9, the classification and measurement changes again, and therefore accounting mismatches also change again. So for these circumstances, the staff recommend that that the entity should revoke previous designations which are no longer valid and should also be allowed to make designations for new accounting mismatches that did not exist before limited modifications were applied. This is the staff recommendation and the rationale. Do you have any questions?
Questions? Yes, I just want to make a comment. I think this whole paper is, to me, good reason that we might want in the future to think about allowing early adoption of any of our standards, because you know, we create such issues for ourselves and our constituents.
Particularly if we do them in phases.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, particularly if we do them in phases, but I think the comparability to me is maybe more important than any other quality of accounting information.
I agree with Paul.
It's just so complex.
Yeah, I mean, my takeaway after I read this, I had a headache. I mean,
you had a headache?
And in my mind, I mean, it's a good reason, I think, to freeze everything in 9 until it's completely done. You know, I really think that the comparability improvements that could be had by early adoption are not there, because they'll be subsequently erased as soon as you adopt the next version of 9, and so on and so on. So
it's a bit late for that, though, isn't it?
The past is the past, you're right, but continue to make the same mistake, let's learn from.
Can I ask a question, though? Before you propose such a proposal, have you discussed with companies or countries who already actually early adopt? Because in the past, some countries or jurisdictions can claim they decide, but after a few years, they say, no, by the end, you know, only one or two companies all actually not happen. Have you discussed with those companies and jurisdictions who actually early adopted?
Early applied.
Early applied.
In general, what we're trying to achieve in this paper is to make sure that entities that already early adopted a version of IFRS 9 is not disadvantaged, that whatever we propose in this paper does not put them in a disadvantaged position, does not change anything for them. Well, that was our key consideration.
My suggestion is you may check with them, you know, even though you had such a kind ideas, you know, to give them something which you feel is good. But they may have different feelings about what you
say. I don't think I'm brave enough to ring anybody who's early applied IFRS 9. But yes, it's a fair suggestion. But I guess that this is going to be an exposure draft, so they'll comment, and I'd expect they'll, having been through the transition of IFRS 9 as well, they may well have other comments more generally on IFRS 9 transition.
I actually have experience of adopting IFRS 9 before I joined the board. So one of the earliest IFRS appliers. So, and this is my purely personal comment, not just really the board member's comment, as a preparer's comment. Perhaps as a preparer, it would be much better for us to have an alternative to choose whether we adopt early application of IFRS 9 or just stay on the IS 39. And the thing is, those who are moving towards the IFRS, they do not want to change twice. That is the most important issue for them. And once you have used IFRS 9, new standard, they don't want to have a quick change afterwards, like we are going to make. So therefore, the change on the IFRS 9 should be very limited, so that that do not give a disadvantage to the new IFRS voluntary early adopter of IFRS 9. So then here comes the question, what should we do for the next new change for the IFRS 9? We could either wait for completion of IFRS 9, or we could allow early application as well. Perhaps for those who have already adopted IFRS 9, probably they would like to have a new IFRS as soon as possible, so that they want to keep the consistency in their IFRS 9. So that is my personal view to answer to your question.
What effective date do we have in mind? We have currently 1.1.15 for the IFRS 9 version 2009-2010. And we are gearing towards the same effective date for the modifications, not a later date. If that is not true, then tax point is valid. People should not be forced to apply the first version and then have, or they at least should have the ability to apply early the new version.
We're assuming that the mandatory effective dates of all of the versions of IFRS 9 should be the same, so we shouldn't get into that situation of people being required to apply two versions.
Yeah, and if that is not possible, we have to rethink some of the problems with the dates.
Okay. Okay, what shall we do?
Well, that's my question. So are there any specific questions that anybody had on the transition papers might be the best?
I think we had a collective explainer here. Let's then take a small break before we start our joint meeting with the FASB.
But we also have a disclosure paper.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So to quickly tee this up for the 10 minutes remaining, just mainly going to ask if anyone has any questions, but I think the key issue in this paper for me relates to the presentation and disclosure of an allowance balance for the fair value OCI debt instruments, and whether that should be either permitted to be presented on the face of the balance sheet or required to be disclosed in the notes. Basically, the staff recommends that this should be neither presented or disclosed for these fair value OCI assets, because to present it on the face of the balance sheet would be a departure from the carrying amount of those assets that are measured at fair value OCI. Did anyone have any questions or comments on that part of it?
Yes, Paul. I'm talking about question five now.
Yes.
But your question five it's about the roll forward. Could you explain how that relates to the balance sheet?
Well, it's questions four and five.
Okay.
So question four is about the presentation on the balance sheet. So whether
I agree with the prohibiting there. But why would you not have the roll forward as a disclosure?
So the reason why there is because the fair value on the balance sheet and then the amortized cost, the expected loss model for the impairment, the way those interact is that you've got basically fair value changes, and then you've also got expected loss impairment, which are two different measurement objectives. And so to pull out one bit of a fair value change isn't really pulling out a part of a whole.
And the allowance would only be part of it, would only be the part.
Yeah.
Okay. I thought it might be more confusing than it was useful.
Yeah.
I have one more question, if I may. On your item two, question two, my answer was no on two. My answer on one was yes, but it seemed to me that question one, saying yes to question one, already captures two. Why doesn't it? Because I didn't even think question two was needed.
Well, question one and IS-1, that requirement IS-1 to disclose the judgments that have had a significant effect on the amounts in the financial statements. My understanding is that's a qualitative disclosure. And so if there were specific quantitative disclosures the board wanted, that would have to be.
So basically IS-1 does not require you to disclose any quantitative information about those significant judgments.
Just requires you to disclose, I haven't got it here in front of me, but something about the effect of your judgments or something about those that would have a significant impact on the financial statements?
Yes, but this is how you scope when you need to provide a disclosure. So if you have significant accounting judgments in applying accounting policies and they have significant impact on your financial statements, you need to provide a disclosure.
That's already required.
Yes, but it is a narrative disclosure about the judgments made. And we feel that quantitative disclosure would also be helpful.
You just have to disclose the judgments that you made in making the assessments.
But no numbers.
That had a significant effect, but you don't really need to put, you don't require specifically quantitative information.
But on this one judgment, we want quantification, we're proposing.
If it has a significant effect on the financial statements, and that's only because in some jurisdictions we know that, a lot of their balance sheet could be affected by these types of instruments.
Can I just ask a question? How can there be a significant when the modification is supposed to be insignificant?
It's not reclassed, it's an issue.
So I put yes for question one and no for two. But what I was thinking is that if the purpose of modification is to ever so slightly do it so that it is insignificant and it's a judgment and all that, then the question comes down and says, disclose it if it's significant. So I thought there is some contradiction that I did not quite understand the contradiction.
Well, but this is significant and insignificant in different contexts. Just imagine you have a company where all financial assets have modified relationships between principal and interest, right? So the relationship is modified. The modification is insignificant, but you do have to apply significant judgment in making the decision that it is insignificant. And so imagine if all your assets are at amortized cost and subject to significant judgment, and they could have been at fair value. This has a big impact on your balance sheet.
Can I try to understand even B a bit better?
I think there's
5 minutes left, and I see three people that want to talk.
You've got lots of time to discuss it later in the week.
Huh?
It's just an education session.
I had one question then. I'll reduce it to one question. I don't understand.
That is always the idea.
I know. Why does it make sense that one would ask both here and in paper 5A for a narrative qualitative disclosure, okay, of essentially the impairment, which could only be done by analysis of the numbers, but yet we won't ask for a disclosure of those numbers? It doesn't make any sense to me.
I ask, why just this one judgment? You could make the same argument for every judgment required in IAS.
I can't make a meaningful disclosure in my notes or my MD&A or anything without actually looking at the numbers.
Is that one question?
This is the same question. I'm trying to understand. How does the staff have an answer? Why would you only recommend qualitative? It doesn't make sense.
Steve, working closely with some of your esteemed colleagues, that was the conclusion that we reached. That it was still useful information to provide qualitatively, even if the quantitative information wasn't useful in itself.
Well, the
still information value in
the rationale.
It's
too burdensome. That was the rationale.
I'm back on questions four and five.
You jumped.
Yeah. I've got a suggestion, and this is in spite of the fact that I'm vehemently opposed to fair value OCI. I'm still trying to be constructive.
And very much appreciated.
What we're lacking, I agree with your recommendations and the questions. I think that's the right solution. It's consistent with the model. But what we're lacking, of course, here is knowing what the balance sheet amortized cost would be. So we've got amortized cost, income statement, fair value, balance sheet, but there is no disclosure of what that amortized cost balance sheet would look like. Why don't you, instead of the proposals which you're rejecting here, create a disclosure that reconciles the fair value, which is on the face of the balance sheet, with what the amortized cost would have been had it been at amortized cost, which of course then is the basis for what you see in the income statement. So amortized cost excluding allowance minus the allowance. It's not really an allowance, of course, because it's not an amortized cost in the balance sheet, but it's what the allowance would have been had it been at amortized cost of the balance sheet, plus or minus the other fair value change equals fair value. So you're not disclosing an allowance, you're not putting an allowance on the balance sheet, you're not rolling forward an allowance, because of course the allowance doesn't exist. But you're showing a disclosure that identifies what amortized cost would be had it been measured at amortized cost, consistent with the way it's presented in the income statement.
Isn't that the same thing as an allowance? So it's the same number.
Yeah, it's the same number, but it's putting it in a more meaningful context.
I disagree.
I guess my question would be, would you only propose or advocate this disclosure for financial assets that are at fair value OCI on the balance sheet, or also for financial assets that are at fair value?
No, only fair value OCI.
And what is the basis?
Because you have the amortized cost data. In order to create your income statement, you have to have all of the amortized cost information. It's trying to give a disclosure that makes the income statement effect of these things more meaningful. Because you're creating in this income statement an impairment allowance, but there's no double entry for this in a sensible way. You've got this rather odd OCI effect, but there's no allowance balance. And that's because the balance sheet is being measured on an entirely different basis. So it just sort of disappears as far as the balance sheet is concerned. But it would be there had the thing been measured at amortized cost. So disaggregate the fair value on the balance sheet into an amortized cost amount and a residual reconciling amount.
And this is a point-in-time disclosure, essentially, rather than a roll-forward, for example.
Not a roll-forward, it's just the balance sheet disclosure. We have a disclosure of fair value for assets measured at amortized cost. So if we believe both amortized cost and fair value information is relevant for this class of assets, then give the opposite. So you've got fair value in the balance sheet, give the amortized cost disclosure in the notes.
Do you think it's really useful, Steve? I mean, I understand what you're saying, I think.
Well, I don't think the whole approach is useful because I don't support fair value OCI. I'm just trying
I know it's a nice double entry and it ties everything up.
But
yeah, I'll take your word.
I think it would be extremely useful because you're going to have these assets accounted for at fair value through P&L, and therefore, but it's impossible to relate then the P&L effects to the balance sheet numbers that generated them unless you know the amortized cost numbers.
But so, why do you want to do that?
For the same reason you relate the net interest margin to the assets that generate the net interest margin on amortized cost from the balance sheet. It's the same purpose.
It's a ratio of some sort.
Ratios.
Then you need average balances.
Yeah. Well, if you have two balance sheets, you can get average balances.
We really have to conclude this meeting, I'm afraid, because the FESB is waiting for us.
Okay. Are they going back?
Okay. Sorry. It was just getting interesting. This.
Tell us about
the primary idea.